Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, we hit the exacta today. Two big Wall Street banks proving bad habits are indeed hard to break. A year and a half after Lehman Brothers went under, we are still learning what went down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the studios of WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 13th of April, everybody, and it is good to have you with us. I sort of can't believe I'm saying this, but details on the spectacular collapse of Lehman Brothers just keep on coming. The New York Times had the latest today. A shadow bank called Hudson Castle that helped Lehman cover up risky investments, the same risky investments that helped bring the economy and eventually the housing market and the whole rest of the economy to its knees. Louise Story wrote the article. Louise, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So explain this thing called Hudson Castle, would you, and its relationship to Lehman Brothers?
You've never heard of Hudson Castle, but they're an obscure firm, very important to Lehman. In 2001, Lehman invested in them and became the biggest shareholder. We uncovered an internal document from Lehman in 2001 that outlines the relationship. And the intention was to have a firm that could lend money to Lehman, but that would be hidden. And this memo says that Lehman would serve as the, quote, internal and external gatekeeper for all business activities conducted by Hudson Castle. Yet, Lehman never discloses to its shareholders.
So do I have it right that basically it let Lehman make its books look better?
It certainly helped Lehman's books that they could borrow money from this outside entity in exchange for some of their more risky assets.
This all sounds very Enron-like. You know, it had all those off-the-books partnerships where it parked its money and its debt and all this stuff. Analogous situation?
We'll leave it to the investigators to determine whether they crossed a line. A lot of these transactions are legal, and a spokesman for Hudson Castle told me that after 2004, when some changes were made, that Hudson Castle controlled all of its own investment decisions, even though Lehman remained the largest shareholder. And you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as the Commission in Washington investigating the financial crisis, are both interested in these sorts of borrowing transactions that Lehman and banks all over Wall Street did, and in some cases continue to do.
Say that again, continue to do.
That's right. So there are all kinds of borrowing transactions that in some cases make your balance sheet look better, that are common practice on Wall Street, and some of them are perfectly kosher, perfectly fine, but it's a very gray area, and that is why the Securities and Exchange Commission is looking at this now. You know, I'm certainly very eager to see what the banks tell the SEC.
Is the issue here really disclosure, that shareholders and investors and the general public just really didn't know this was going on?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that a lot of bank executives have told us since the financial crisis that even they did not know the risk that were buried in the bowels of their companies. And, you know, accounting experts think part of this is because very important details have been left in footnotes or not even in the footnotes at all in this shadow banking systems of firms like Hudson Castle, the one I wrote about, and that this shadow banking system masked the risk even sometimes from people at the company, not to mention investors, regulators, and the public.
So where does this all play out? Are we going to be reading articles like this and learning about issues like this for years to come now?
Well, there is certainly a lot to digest out of the financial crisis, and this issue of transparency around bank risk-taking will be one that we'll continue to cover because it would be important to any future crisis prevention for us to better understand what's going on with these companies.
Louise Story from the New York Times had a story this morning on Hudson Castle and Lehman Brothers and its borrowing operations. Louise, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Wall Street today, the major indices kept their heads above water. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Even if you don't use it, you probably at least heard of Twitter, where users post brief messages online, tweets they're called, about whatever's going on in somebody's life. The site has exploded from a couple of 100,000 users last year to more than 22 million today. People have Twitter feeds, companies have Twitter feeds, Marketplace has a Twitter feed. But as with a lot of other social networking phenomena, there has been a lingering question of when Twitter was actually going to start making money. Today may be the answer. Marketplace's Rico Galliano looked into Twitter's new ad plan.
This morning I logged into Twitter, and in the search field, I typed the word coffee. Because, you know, I was drinking some. And the first tweet that comes up is from Starbucks. And it says, "Our coffee quality team tastes thousands of cups a year to ensure quality." Now, Starbucks posted that tweet 3 days ago, yet it still appeared at the top of the search results, which are usually chronological. This is Twitter's new ad model at work. Aaron Kessler is an internet analyst at Kaufman Brothers.
It's called promoted tweets, and that's essentially when a user searches on a specific keyword, an advertisement would show up at the top of the page.
Starbucks, Best Buy, and a few other companies are now paying to have their tweets promoted like this on Twitter. Kessler says the strategy is fairly common on the internet. Google does something similar. But what could be controversial is Twitter's plan for a second ad experiment later this year.
Advertisements within the overall Twitter feed. So even when if a user doesn't search for that item, they may still see an advertisement.
He says the ads would appear based on what a user was tweeting about. Mention travel, a Virgin Airline tweet might appear in your Twitter feed. Right now, to hear about Virgin deals, you have to follow them. Soon, they may be following you. Kit Yarrow is a consumer psychology professor at Golden Gate University. She says some users could be turned off by the Big Brother aspect, at least at first.
And there's going to be an adjustment period where people are feeling initially like they're being violated in some way.
But she points out users once felt the same way about email intrusions and just got used to deleting or ignoring them. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Turning a profit while you till your field is what farmers try to do. One of the big variables about that is deciding which seeds to plant. For the past 15 years or so, more farmers have been choosing genetically modified seeds for crops bred with specific traits like resistance to insects or to drought. Today, the National Research Council released a report evaluating the profitability of those genetically modified crops. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Caitlin Carroll reports.
This report says farmers spend less on pesticides and get bigger crops from genetically modified seeds. Peter Raven heads the botanical garden in St. Louis and contributed to the report. He says the sturdier the crops, the less time farmers have to spend weeding and watering.
The main benefit from growing GM crops for farmers is that they get about 30% of their time back.
Yeah, I don't know about the... I don't know if I would necessarily agree with 30% less time. It certainly is a lot more efficient.
That's Keith Ryan. I caught up with him as he was planting corn on his farm in Taylorville, Illinois. Ryan says when you have built-in traits like insect resistance, you don't have to drench the crops with insecticide.
You don't have to mess with getting all the insecticide on you personally and deal with the ramifications that come with that down the road.
But the report says a number of weeds are developing resistance to Roundup, a popular weed killer that doesn't damage genetically engineered crops. Analyst Bill Fries at the Center for Food Safety says the South is seeing some of the worst effects of this new resistance.
There are weeds down there that farmers are using 7 or 8 different chemicals and still can't kill. So now they're going back to hand weeding, which hasn't been seen for decades.
Authors of the report say farmers' heavy dependence on Roundup contributed to this situation. Farmer Keith Ryan says as other herbicides have come down in price, farmers have been using them in tandem with Roundup. But weed resistance is inevitable. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Senators John Kerry and Lindsey Graham say they'll unveil their new climate change bill by next week sometime. But between health care and financial reform and a Supreme Court nomination, it could kind of get lost in the shuffle. Environmentalist and author Bill McKibben says it's already too late to prevent global warming. What we have to do now is find a way to cope with our new reality. His new book is called Earth, Making Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill, it's good to talk to you.
As always, Kai.
This book, for those who can't see it out there, the title is Earth, with the unconventional spelling of E-A-A-R-T-H. Help me out there.
The conceit is that we really have built a new planet, substantially different enough from the one that we were born onto to warrant a new name. This Earth that we live on now has 5% more moisture in the atmosphere than the one 50 years ago. Its oceans are turning steadily acid. We're seeing dramatic increases both in drought and in deluge, enough so that we've really begun to alter not only the ecological fabric of the planet, but the economic fabric as well.
It kind of feels on a day-to-day basis like the same old place.
It does until something happens. I recount the story of our small town and the fact that summer before last, we had the two biggest rainstorms ever recorded there. That kind of storm is now happening someplace around the world every single day. This is a different world. It so far doesn't feel entirely different. It just feels a little different.
So how do we recalibrate? Do we just get used to living smaller and less complicated and closer to home?
Well, that's certainly part of it. We need to do two things. One, put a price on carbon so that we really begin to wean ourselves aggressively from fossil fuel. Even when we do that, we'd be very wise to re-examine our economic life, stop thinking constantly about expansion, and start thinking more about security. That implies getting away from too big to fail, not just in banking, but in energy, in agriculture, in almost everything we do.
Take me through one of those big fixed investments that you spend some time on in the book, agriculture. How do we deconstruct that so that it becomes sustainable?
Right now, soil has become a kind of matrix for holding your corn upright while you apply fossil fuel. We need to get back to a very different kind of agriculture, one that's much more diverse and is much more localized. And that's beginning to happen, Guy. The fastest growing part of the food economy for the last decade has been local farmers' markets.
I don't want to get all macroeconomic on you here, Bill, but just to go back to basic economics and Adam Smith, I mean, the opening lines of Wealth of Nations, the book that he wrote, was consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production. I mean, that's why you have economies, is to grow and get bigger.
He didn't say that it's to grow forever getting bigger. In fact, he was pretty clear that there was a place at which that no longer made sense. What economists have failed to realize from the beginning, the economy is a subset of something else, and that something else is the natural world. There comes a point at which infinite growth no longer works. This is the moment, finally, when those limits are at hand.
You're probably the last guy I need to tell this to, but there are fundamentally two responses to a book like this. One is to put your fingers in your ears and say, la, 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 because it's really just so depressing that you can't even comprehend it. Or, as you say in the book, you get out into the basement and you start oiling your guns because the apocalypse is nigh. What are you supposed to do about those responses?
You know, I've spent the last 2 or 3 years of my life organizing these largest scale global environmental movement we've seen. At the same time, I've been doing all kinds of work in the place where I live, in my town in Vermont. We need to work at that local scale and at that global. It's true that we've taken the sweet earth on which we were born and degraded it in pretty powerful ways. There's already damage. There will be more. So we better figure out how to live on the planet we have left.
Bill McKibben's latest offering is a book called Earth. That's E-A-A-R-T-H. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai, so much.
For a long time, before it went under, Washington Mutual had this catchy tagline it used in its ads to show that it could help everybody buy a home. The power of yes, it went. Well, a new Senate investigation shows that WAMU wasn't just talking the talk. Widespread fraud let it say yes to just about everybody. And that might have helped set the bar for the whole darn market. Marketplace's Lisa Roth reports.
The stories this investigation have turned up are pretty alarming. WAMU gave bonuses for selling higher-risk loans. There were also bonuses for using things like higher interest rates or extra points to overcharge clients. Employees even helped loans get processed faster by falsifying bank statements. John Coffey's an expert on securities law and corporate governance at Columbia. He says the easiest way for a bank to increase its profitability in the short term is to take on more risk.
And that can arguably produce the lemming-like race over the cliff as each institution increases its level of risk because it wants to have its profitability look at least comparable to its rivals.
He says WaMu was one of a lot of institutions in the game. There's no proof that anybody else was engaging in the same kinds of questionable practices, but everybody ignored the bigger issue that the market for these mortgages was unsustainable. Thomas Cooley's an economics professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU. He says we should also blame the ratings agencies and the big banks who bought the securitized mortgages because they enabled WaMu.
Their ability to do what they did was dependent on other parts of the financial system being willing to purchase the assets that they created. So it was a kind of a collective failure of common sense in a lot of ways and a collective breakdown of the system.
There are more hearings scheduled for Friday to look at the role of regulators. After those hearings, Senate investigators will decide whether to refer the case to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, the land grab is on for oil.
We bought leases for $100, $150 an acre. And in a period of 6 months, we went from $250 an acre to $25,000 an acre.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials kept its head above 11,000. Today it rose a tenth of 1%, 13 points, closed at 11,019. The NASDAQ inched up a third of 1%, 8 points, closed at 2465. The S&P 500 hiked a tenth percent, just a point, ended at 1196. A disappointing earnings report from Alcoa yesterday afternoon weighed on the market. Alcoa's shares dropped 1.5% today. Mining companies rattled lower as well. Timberline Resources dug down 4%. Metalline Mining plowed 17% lower. Clothing retailer stitched up some nice gains after Talbot's released good earnings. The company zipped up nearly 5%, followed by the Dress Barn, which racked up a 1.3% gain, and Ann Taylor, which dressed up 3%. Today, the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at GoToMyPC.com/market. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for March. The Labor Department releases its monthly consumer price index. And CEOs of coal mining companies testify at a hearing on Capitol Hill. The House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming examines the role of coal in a new energy age. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Letters are indeed where we find ourselves today. A lot of you wrote about our coverage of a big court decision last week. A federal appeals court had said the Federal Communications Commission cannot stop the Comcasts of the world from blocking users based on how much bandwidth those users use. Hulu addicts may wind up having a problem with that, but our commentator said not to worry. It'd be bad business for internet providers to restrict their customers. Greg Cox of Raleigh, North Carolina said, I don't think so.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that a profit-driven corporation wouldn't pour tons of money into a protracted legal battle just to prove a point. They obviously see traffic shaping as being in their business interest.
Spirit Airlines recently announced a solution to what it sees as its business interests. They're going to charge for carry-on bags. That's on top of the fees they already charge for checked bags and, oh yeah, the ticket prices too. So Sally Cutler of Cato, New York had an idea. Why not charge based on the total weight that a passenger wants to bring aboard?
Set a standard per passenger weight allowance, then weigh the passengers and all their bags. Over the allowance, pay an additional fee. Shipping people should be like shipping a package. You pay by weight.
I talked to Hollywood producer Jerry Weintraub last week about how he got his start. With $1 million scraped together in 24 hours and a concert deal with Elvis, Jerry Weintraub was on his way to making it big. But a lot of you wondered where the heck all that money came from.
I was disappointed not to hear how Mr. Weintraub was able to get a hold of $1 million in a day.
That's John Leeds of Piermont, New York. Sorry to say, Mr. Leeds, that that part of the interview hit the cutting room floor, but we brought it back to life just because you all asked. Here's the basic story boiled down to its essence. Weintraub called everybody he knew. Finally, somebody said, hey, I know a guy who knows a guy. Call him. So Jerry did.
And he said to me, what will you give me for $1 million? I said, I'll give you half of my concert business. He said, okay, I'm going to send my lawyers to see your lawyers and we'll make a deal. I said, no, you don't understand. I need $1 million now, but you can trust me. My word is my bond. In those days, we did business like that. People shook hands. People talked to each other. We had no computers. The internet didn't exist. And if you made a deal with somebody, you made a deal.
Yeah, for the good old days, right? When a deal was a deal. Anyway, finally, maybe the best listener letter we have ever gotten came after our story on Muslims and Jews working together to provide meat that's both kosher and halal. Nick Gorton of Davis, California called it a two-steak solution. I love that. I thought that was great. If you'd like to share something tasty or if something we said gave you heartburn, write to us, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Crude prices slipped a little bit today. On the one hand, traders seem worried producers could pump more crude than we're going to need. On the other, they're thinking if oil goes much above $85 or so dollars a barrel, the recovery could stall. It is an uncertain time. But some energy companies thrive on that uncertainty. Independent oil and gas producers are used to risking everything on a single drill. Wildcatters pioneered the business of dragging fossil fuels out of the ground, and they are still at it today, despite big oil. From Shreveport, Louisiana, Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio has the story.
Jack Everett's one of the oldest men in the oil business. He's 81, and he reckons he's drilled about 1,000 oil and gas wells in his lifetime.
I'm just an old land man that hustles. Got to drill a lot of wells to find the right one.
Everett drills as many wells that he can finance each year in hopes that a handful will pay off, and he does it the old-fashioned way. He doesn't use banks. Instead, he gets his money from a group of trusted investors. These old-timey wildcatters, as he calls them, have been sponsoring Everett for decades.
I take people that I deal with on their word. Handshake means more to me than anything you can put in writing. You can tear that letter up.
You might think the big oil and gas companies would have killed off wildcatters like Everett by now, but there are thousands of independent operators just like him.
We're very small, we're very quick, we're very nimble.
Kevin Byram is one of the new generation of wildcatters. Thanks to technology, his laptop computer can serve up and crunch exactly the same data that the big players get. And many independents like him are scientists. Byram spent years studying geology before he set up his own business, Heritage Energy. Right now, he's prospecting for natural gas in a discovery called the Haynesville Shale just outside of Shreveport, Louisiana. I climbed several stories to get to the driller's control cabin of Byram's rig. It gives a skybox-like view of the drill pipe boring 3 miles down into the earth.
You ain't scared of heights, are you?
No, not at all. The height is the least of a wildcatter's worries. It costs $9 million to drill one of these wells, $60,000 a day. And a lot can go wrong. The drill pipe can break, the mud lubricant may not work right, or worse yet, a sudden pressure change can trigger a deadly blowout. Delays from accidents or equipment failure can easily bankrupt an operator, but perhaps the biggest risk of all is not finding enough natural gas to make the well pay off.
Do you have, as a geologist, any indication how good this well will be at this point?
No, it's all mechanical now. You know, one, you got to get it drilled, which is not easy. There's not a whole lot of geology anymore.
Byram is prepared to take big risks with his balance sheet, pouring his own money into his drilling program. Because he's an independent operator, he can gamble in a way publicly traded heavyweights can't. Joe Colanetta invests in pipeline operations for HM Capital Partners, a private equity firm. He says the Wildcatters' ability to move quickly and make big bets often get them to the sweetest drilling spots first, but the big guys soon catch up.
There tends to be a lot of intrigue and espionage that occurs in the dark of the night, and so the bigger companies that have the manpower to sort of spy and scope out who's doing what in the independent community are able to go in and lease up a bunch of acreage.
And once the big oil and gas firms open their checkbooks, the whole game changes. Byram says it turns into a land grab.
In the North Louisiana Basin, we bought leases for $100, $150 an acre. And in a period of 6 months, we went from $250 an acre to $25,000 an acre. I mean, it just got totally out of hand.
Wildcatters like Byram often can't match that kind of money, so they usually sell up and take their profits and then move on to the next prospect with little more than their instincts, an honest handshake, and a firm hope that all that newfangled geological drilling data is on the money. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. By Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a last word for today on Wall Street banks in the aftermath of the financial crisis. College commencement season is almost upon us, but some students and alumni at Syracuse University want nothing to do with the school's chosen speaker. They have asked the administration to remove JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon from the program. Their petition says they are against having their graduation used, and this is a quote, to restore the public image of the banking industry. So there you have that. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 13 points. That's about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ ticked up 8 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 inched up a single point, a 10th percent. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Thanks also today to the staff here at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Coming up next time on the broadcast, in France, when homelessness and abandoned homes collide.
If there were not people out, you know, in the streets, it would be good. But there are a lot of people who could use those houses, and we don't understand why those houses are empty.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.